open the House Committee on Rural Communities, Land Use, and Water. Today is March 31st. Apologize for those who've been here for an hour or more waiting. We went a little long on our floor debate and felt my committee members needed to eat so they could listen with greater attentiveness. Let me open a public hearing on House Bill 3217. I can comment a little bit on this bill, but for the sake of time, I might save that for as needed or as necessary, and instead just get our witnesses who've traveled to be here up. So Martha Pagel, Gordon Grant, and Alan Higginbottom. Works out well. We have three in favor and three opposed. So we can, and then one agency person who probably like to run and hide. So we'll just. Great.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Shall I start? Thank you. For the record, my name is Martha Pagel. I'm an attorney with the firm of Schwabe, Williamson, and Wyatt. I'm here today representing the Sylvie's Valley Ranch, which is a large ranch in Sylvie's Valley in eastern Oregon. And they've been involved for a number of years now in kind of experimental efforts with the development of what they call artificial beaver dams. And this concept that you're dealing with today is intended to learn from that experience and create a pilot program for simplifying the permitting process so that this type of strategy for stream flow recovery and ecosystem recovery can be replicated at other ranches in the area. I know that we're on press for time. I have a written statement, which do you have that? Great. I've been working on water and natural resources issues in Oregon for more than 30 years now. I have a perspective of nearly 20 years in state government service, former director of the Oregon Water Resources Department and Department of State Lands, very much involved with the removal fill program in my background. I know a good program when I see it. And this concept is a good program. It is a way to open the door for voluntary measures by private landowners to try to recover, restore stream systems, and create habitat that will allow for more natural conditions to persist over time. I've been asked about the label artificial beaver dams, and this concept is that by some level of human intervention, you can recreate the hydrology, the process that, and the function that beaver served in these stream systems historically. And by doing that, the idea is to bring back natural beaver populations. So the goal here is to recover stream systems to the point where they can support a natural beaver population. And that results in both benefits to the public through healthier stream systems and benefits to the private landowner through more productive upland meadows and grazing lands for these landowners. So what 3217 does is recognize severe problems that we have with erosion on stream systems in eastern Oregon. It promotes voluntary stream restoration by private landowners. It does that by creating a pilot program in the Department of State Lands to simplify the process for obtaining authorization under the state removal fill law. It is not an end run around permitting. It is using the tools that exist now for either general authorization or general permits to be issued, and it will rely on further rulemaking by DSL to set the sideboards and the parameters for the specific projects that could be allowed under this pilot program. It also waives this passage, and I want to point out that that waiver is not because of an intention to do any harm to fish, but rather recognizing that these degraded stream systems that we're working with right now, for the most part, would be entitled to waivers under the process in the fish passage law to begin with. They are not streams that are healthy habitat for fish. But once these measures are taken and the benefits are realized, then they can be healthy habitat for fish. And at that point, you can talk about fish passage. So the idea is not to do anything harmful to fish, but rather to, again, set up this pilot project and recognize the potential benefits that can be gleaned. I'll let my colleagues here at the table talk about more of technically why this program is needed and the function of the artificial beaver dams. I've laid out what the bill would do. Want to clarify what the bill would not do. As I mentioned, it does not create an exemption from permitting requirements. It creates a simplified process for these pilot projects to go forward. It does not authorize water use. I've had questions come up to me about whether this is really just a way to get water for irrigation or for other purposes. It doesn't do that. These artificial beaver dams are mimicking natural beaver dams, which are not for the purpose of storing water for future use. They're the slowing down water. So the dams leak and the water flow continues. We've been working with the Oregon Water Resources Department at Sylvie's Valley Ranch. We don't have issues relating to water rights. So this is not an end run around water rights or around the removal fill program. As I mentioned, I've been at this business a long time. The work that's been done on Sylvie's Valley Ranch through private efforts and a sincere effort to help promote stream restoration, they've had some very good results. I think this is a great idea for trying to promote voluntary actions in other places, and I think this is an opportunity for you to lay the groundwork for that to happen. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. My name is Gordon Grant, and I'm a research hydrologist and geomorphologist with the USDA Forest Service Pacific Northwest Research Station. I'm also a courtesy professor of geosciences at Oregon State University. My testimony here is intended to provide context and technical background for the bill under consideration. My position as a federal scientist specifically prohibits me from advocating for or against legislation. The broader context that motivates this bill is the current status of streams and watersheds across eastern Oregon and indeed across the American West. Many of the streams you see today in this region have undergone significant change over the past century or more. Specifically, many of the streams and valleys that today appear as deeply cut down or in size gullies or arroyos bordered by wide valleys of sagebrush were once wet or marshy meadows filled with wetland vegetation and drained by wandering shallow streams, typically punctuated by beaver dams and ponds. We know this because of the record of ponded silts and muds now revealed in these steep gully walls. The causes of these incised channels has been hotly debated since the incision began over a century ago. Cattle and sheep grazing, changes in the climate, human activities to ditch and drain meadows for agriculture, and widespread trapping and decimation of the beaver population have all been implicated, and the jury is still out as to what the dominant mechanisms are. But there is no doubt the loss of the beaver and their dams, that ponded water, stored sediment, and built up the valley bottoms was a major factor in transforming these waterways. Because these channels have cut down 5, 15, or even 30 feet or more in places, the channels now flow at elevations far below their former floodplains. Without deliberate and thoughtful interventions, they cannot return to their previous levels and recover their function. A number of different strategies have been proposed and in places implemented in order to raise the level of the water in the channels back to their former floodplains. One plausible, and in my view, particularly successful strategy has been to build so-called artificial beaver dams, small, low-head weirs made of natural materials of rock, wood, or some combination thereof. The purpose of these artificial beaver dams, or ABDs as they're sometimes referred to, is several-fold. First, much like beaver dams, they impede the flow, creating a chain of ponds interspersed by small steps. If properly engineered, these ponds raise the water table back up to the level of the valley floor, killing the valley sagebrush and other dryland species, and making it possible for wet meadow vegetation and grass to grow once again adjacent to the channel. This introduces both hydraulic and ecological complexity into the channelways and makes it possible for aquatic and riparian habitats for fish, beavers, and other species to become reestablished. Building the structures first is a necessary condition for reintroducing beavers into these areas. Without their preferred habitat, the beavers cannot build the dams by themselves and will not reoccupy the channels even if deliberately reintroduced. But once the ABDs are in place, native species that are an essential part of the beaver diets can become established, and the beavers will return and often occupy and maintain the artificial beaver dams as if they had built them in the first place. Although the effects of building ABDs are striking and dramatic and dramatically change landscapes rather rapidly, usually 1 to 3 years, the full consequences of this restoration strategy are not well understood. To address this, a consortium of scientists representing a diverse set of scientific institutions, including the Pacific Northwest Research Station and Oregon State University, have established the Cottonwood Creek Watershed Observatory in the Sylvies River Valley. The purpose of this observatory is to evaluate the effects of artificial beaver dams and other restoration strategies on water supply, ecosystem functions and health, and habitat for a wide range of organisms. Results of this research will be widely available to the public, other ranchers, land managers, and the regulatory community to help guide new approaches and strategies for restoring watersheds. From my perspective, the challenge of restoring eastern Oregon waterways and habitats can be achieved, but it will require innovative strategies, collaborations, and experimentation. The proposed legislation seems consistent with these broad goals. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to testify. My name is Alan Hickenbottom. I'm on the board of the Oregon Natural Desert Association. I'm here today representing Brent Fenty, who's our executive director, who couldn't make it to Portland today. Asked me if I could fill in. Thank you for this opportunity to provide testimony on House Bill 3217. The Oregon Natural Desert Association is an Oregon nonprofit public interest conservation organization of over 4,500 members and supporters. We exist to protect, defend, and restore the health of Oregon's native deserts, and we have a long history of monitoring ecologic conditions and wilderness values throughout eastern Oregon. We actively participate in watershed restoration and decisions concerning land management in eastern Oregon. Over the past decade, we've been actively working with a diverse group of stakeholders throughout Oregon's high desert to restore streams and recover native beaver populations. ONDA has engaged thousands of volunteers in these efforts, one of whom is me. I have the back to show it. Our work is focused primarily in the John Day River and Mount Hear Lake basins. Examples of our work include a longstanding partnership with the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs to restore Pine Creek, steelhead-bearing tributary of the lower John Day, partnership with NOAA, National Park Service and the BLM, and private landowners to restore and recover Bridge Creek, another tributary of the John Day, and monitoring the Sylvie's Valley Ranch along with Scott Campbell on the Mount Hear, in the Mount Hear Lake Basin. These efforts have spanned over a decade and includes thousands of hours of project planning, on-the-ground work, and monitoring. ONDA has advocated for passive restoration in many areas throughout our high desert, in areas such as the Heart Mountain Refuge. The removal of livestock has shown significant benefits to stream recovery. However, in many areas throughout Oregon's high desert, streams have become significantly entrenched and therefore disconnected from the historic floodplain, and I think the photos in your packet are quite illustrative of that. This has limited the watershed's ability to store water. As a result, the streams experience rapid runoff, and there's limited or sometimes no ability for riparian and streamside vegetation to recover. Instead, these areas become dominated by upland vegetation, such as western juniper and sagebrush. Without this habitat and structure, it is nearly impossible for beaver to naturally cover these streams where they are historically abundant. Although I can say on a side note that if you give them a chance, they'll come. I live in central southwest Portland, and there's a beaver half a mile from my house. It's unbelievable on Fano Creek. Somebody must have put an ABD in. The importance of beaver to these systems cannot be overstated. Beavers are ecosystem engineers that were historically responsible for expanding wetland habitat that is critical to myriad fish and wildlife species. This role has been increasingly recognized in both scientific literature and the popular press. Beaver recovery is also recognized as a potential way to address threats of water shortage associated with climate change. Examples of benefits associated with beaver including slowing of snowmelt runoff, creation of ponds and wetlands benefiting fish, amphibians, and small mammals, increased groundwater recharge, and I won't go farther into benefits, but were spoken very well by my colleague to my left. Specific to artificial beaver dams, it is important to note a potential drawback of this approach. Over the past field season, although we have documented benefits such as increased water tables, we have also documented higher water temperatures at dam sites. Our expectation is that as riparian vegetation recovers, these water temperature effects will be mitigated. For the sites described in this legislation, this is not a pressing issue because the pilot project is limited to streams that are not perennial and do not have resident fish populations. However, to the extent that this pilot project is successful and potentially expanded to other sites, it will be important at that time to have a better understanding of such effects to ensure that the structures do not significantly impact resident fish populations. Likewise, Onda suggests that the term artificial beaver dam in Section 2A should be further defined to ensure that structures are not overbuilt. Our experience has shown that although such structures may have short-term benefits to retain water, they need to be built in a way that allows the stream to reclaim its historic meander over time and therefore ultimately allow more natural conditions to develop. In developing this effort, it is important to note that there are new tools that will dramatically assist our efforts to more accurately understand historic beaver range and ensure that restoration is targeting the right places. Recent research in Oregon and Utah should be considered as regional priorities are developed and experts in this field should be engaged in such evaluations. These efforts by Utah State University and fellow researchers are particularly noteworthy because they will help us address questions regarding dam frequency and location and therefore should inform future implementation. Onda strongly supports scientifically credible evaluation of projects to ensure robust project design and inform future efforts for the best available information. Collaboration among landowners with the Malheur Lake Basin, conservation organizations, land managers, and other diverse stakeholders will continue to improve our common understanding of these ecosystems and inform how we can recover beaver to benefit ecological function and human needs. Thank you again for the opportunity to provide these perspectives regarding HB 32, and we are pleased to offer our support of this effort.
Thank you. Thank you.
Questions for this panel? Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a committee bill, so I'm not sure where to direct this question, and I thought I'd start perhaps with the panel of advocates that are here. And I don't want you to take this as confrontive because it's a question we ask on a frequent basis, but this example just cries out for the question relating to artificial beaver dams and creating an emergency. And the question is, do you feel there's something in this proposal that has sufficient urgency that would require it to go into effect on passage rather in the normal time frame?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gomberg, I'll take a stab at the emergency clause was inserted to be able to get a head start on the program and setting it up so that we can have it in place hopefully by the next work season. So the benefits of being able to move ahead quickly would be realized on the ground a year from now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's a good answer, and we hear it all the time, but it seems to me we're seeing more emergencies than not these days.
Any other questions?
He didn't ask what I was going to say.
Okay, great. Thank you.
If I may, yeah. Mr. Chair, I failed to point out the photos that were attached to my testimony. I just wanted to explain that the first photos obviously demonstrate just some examples of the cut down that you see, and the last two photos of Hay Creek show the great results that were on one of the oldest projects that had been undertaken. This isn't actually on Sylvie's Valley Ranch, but on another property in the same area owned by the same landowner.
Okay. Just one sec. Vice Chair Post.
It was the last picture?
The last picture is the recovered area.
Okay,
that's the successful
great.
Area.
Thank you.
That's what we're looking for.
Okay.
And maybe I can just make sure I get something on the record. This bill is prospective only and wouldn't do anything to deal with ABDs already built.
Correct. Prospective only.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
And let me get Brian Posowitz, Tom Wolf, and Jim Myron. Agency list. Up. I've got Brian first, but whatever preference you have.
That's fine.
Thank you. Chair Clem, members of the committee. My name is Brian Posowitz. I'm a staff attorney for an organization called Water Watch of Oregon. Water Watch is a nonprofit organization that works to protect and restore stream flows in Oregon for the benefit of people who enjoy fish, wildlife, and recreation. This year, Water Watch celebrates its 30th anniversary. Water Watch supports innovative new approaches for watershed restoration. I've had a conversation with at least one of the proponents of this bill last week, and I understand there are some good intentions behind the bill. That said, Water Watch has some significant concerns about the bill and opposes the bill as drafted. In general, we don't understand at this point why it is that the stated objectives of the bill, to basically recreate some of the environmental benefits of beaver dams, can't be accomplished within the existing regulatory structure. In our view, requiring dams to provide fish passage, requiring a permit to remove and fill stream beds, and protecting riparian areas are all good ideas. In particular, we are concerned about provisions of this bill that would exempt these artificial beaver dams from Oregon's fish passage laws. Oregon's fish passage laws have been carefully crafted over the years to balance the interests of property owners who want to put a dam in a stream with the interest of all Oregonians in ensuring that native migratory fish can move freely within a stream system. And that balance is reflected in things like there are waivers and exemption provisions for appropriate cases. Just to give you a flavor of it, the waiver provisions basically say you have to be able to show that you will provide an overall net benefit for fish if you're not going to provide fish passage. That's roughly speaking. But my point is there's some flexibility in the fish passage laws that we think could be used to address this kind of situation. And we also think fish passage should probably be provided at most of these dams. Now, the bill would only apply on streams they're not used by red band trout or by game fish for spawning, rearing, or food production. And so somebody might say, well, why do we need to worry about fish passage there? Well, a couple of reasons. One, although game fish may not use the stream for any of those purposes, they may use it for migration. Number two, there are native migratory fish that require fish passage that aren't game fish. Number three, all of these fish may be using these streams at some point in the future. And the fish passage laws quite wisely recognize that possibility, and they require fish passage not only in streams presently used by native migratory fish, but in streams that have historically been used by native migratory fish. And the purpose of that is, I think, that is in recognition of the fact that we want to recover some of these streams, and we don't want that to be prevented by an absence of fish passage. So we think the fish passage laws are really important, and an exemption from those laws is pretty dangerous. Finally, Water Watch would like the bill to be clear about whether there is any kind of implied exemption from Oregon's water permitting regime. My understanding from talking to the proponents is that they don't see it that way. They think these dams don't require permits from water resources, from the Water Resources Department. Our view is actually a little different. I'm not sure we agree with that position that these don't require permits from water resources. But in any event, we think the bill should be clear about that, and then if it moves forward, it should say something to the effect of the bill is not providing any kind of exemption or modification to existing law other than as expressly stated in the bill. And just one final point I'd make is I think you heard in a lot of in some of the testimony that the impacts of these artificial beaver dams, a lot of it is sort of still being studied and still being worked out. And so I'm kind of wondering as I hear that, maybe we should be looking for some more conclusive information before pursuing this approach. And with that, thank you for the chance to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Finish the panel.
Chair Clem, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, the executive director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. I'm here to raise some concerns about House Bill 3217. First of all, it's a very commendable idea, you know, creating artificial beaver dams to restore hydrology to the system. But having run this by our senior scientist, Jack Williams, who for Trout Unlimited happens to live in Medford, he raised some very good concerns, and I've sent in my testimony to O list, and it's in the record already. Plus, there's some papers about the importance of beavers that are on there also that I hope you read. But I'm just going to go through briefly some of his concerns. Artificial dams don't exactly mimic beaver dams. I mean, they certainly provide some function, but not the function that beavers do. For example, when beavers build dams, they're made entirely of wood. That wood provides material for the macroinvertebrates within the pond, the area, the lake, or whatever you want to, that they create, that the will provide food for the fish that reside in the ponds. Beaver dams provide fish passage. If you go up and look at beaver dams, you'll notice that fish are able to pass back and forth because they're not they're not solid structures. They have holes in them. Beaver dams can be blown out. That may not sound like a bad thing, but what it does is it releases water at critical times for the hydrology of the streams, and then you have the world's best engineers there to fix them, repair them, and bring them back. So, and you can't mimic those in an artificial dam. And so those are just some key points I'd like to bring. So I'm not saying that this bill shouldn't be explored, and certainly Brian's comments from Water Watch certainly raised some key points too, but we need to explore this carefully. I've been working on fish issues for over 25 years, and I'm always wary, Larry, of man's attempt to mimic nature. I mean, it seems to me that maybe if there's any way we can to look at ways to reintroduce natural beaver into the system, and working with ODFW to do so, maybe that would be a better solution. Again, not saying that this bill doesn't have merits, but I think there's some valid concerns that need to be addressed before this bill goes forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Myron, representing the Native Fish Society. I'll try and not repeat some of the things that that Mr. Posowitz and Mr. Wolf have raised, but we too have some concerns with the bill. I won't read through our written testimony. It is also on OLIS, but you know, we share the concerns that have already been raised. If the intent of this this concept and this bill is to truly create some kind of a pilot project where you can study and find out more and find the answers to some of these questions, that, so then you could replicate it in a larger area. At least one suggestion with the bill is don't have it apply to the entire Malheur Lakes Basin, because the Malheur Lakes Basin runs from the Strawberry Mountains on the north to the Steens Mountain on the south. Includes all of the Sylvies River drainage and all of the Blitzen River drainage. So if your focus is some projects in the Sylvies, then limit it to a small area.
It's not really
in
Sylvies, because Sylvies is already done. It's actually the rest of the place that we're, I think, interested in. Sylvies is already done thousands. And so it's not Sylvies that would benefit from this bill. Unfortunately for them, they've already paid and gone through the process. It would be the next round of people, I think, who were interested in not having to go through the same types of processes that Sylvies went through.
Well, okay, then why not expand it to include the Crooked River drainage as well? There's a lot of incised channels in the upper Crooked River as well, so.
I think the challenge there is that runs into where, to, if I understand it right, it eventually flows into places where you would have ocean-going fish,
yeah,
and
they're
the other one's a closed loop that, you know, was a better place to start than trying to take on what it might do to salmon and steelhead.
Okay, well, it just doesn't seem appropriate to call it a pilot project, but maybe that's just my problem.
It could be.
So, thank you. I'd be happy to respond to any questions. And let me close by saying we think the idea of restoring beaver populations on the landscape and all the benefits they provide is a really great goal, and we'd like to see that accomplished throughout the state. Part of the problem is beavers are still considered to be a predator and are eradicated most of the places they're found. So that's another little statutory twist that you might want to consider fixing.
Okay, questions? Les, your post.
Thank you, Chair Clem. Gentleman from Water Watch. Just a quick question. I wrote it down as you were talking. We were talking about the fish passage. The question came to me, what did the fish do when the beavers were more prevalent? Were we worried about fish passage then?
Chair Clem, Representative Post. In my conversations with fish biologists on this issue, I've asked them this question. What about beaver dams? Do they impair fish passage? And the answer that I have heard is that for reasons that may or may not be totally understood, they don't seem to. The fish seem to be able to migrate past beaver dams. That's the best understanding I have, although I can't claim to be an expert on the issue. But I have heard that from fish biologists.
So, okay, can you follow up? So is it your contention because the beaver dam was made out of, as you said, different materials, then this artificial dam would be, then would be, that's why it's different?
Chair Clem, Representative Post, I think if these dams were fish passable like beaver dams, they wouldn't need an exemption from the fish passage laws, that as long as they're providing fish passage, they're going to comply with the fish passage laws. My understanding is that real beaver dams have not prevented fish passage, and if these artificial beaver dams are not going to prevent fish passage, why exempt them from the fish passage laws? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Okay.
So, Tom, I want to make sure your person in Medford, was it? Here's what Gordon Grant had to say about the need to prepare the habitat first, otherwise beavers can't be reintroduced without some of the conditions that they need to prosper, because they've got predator challenges. If there's not enough shade or cover, if there's no water at all in there, it's just a big dry ravine. They're not going to go there there's no food for them. So what you'll find, I think, in discussions with people like Gordon Grant or Onda, is after they build the beaver dams, then real beavers will go and go right on top of them and start making their own. You could even remove them at some point, I think.
I'd be happy to put Gordon in touch with Jack and have them talk, because, like I said, we thought the idea was commendable. We just had our concerns. So be happy to set up a conversation so they can talk about that.
And I took notes briefly, but maybe, Brian, you can help us with actual language, too, about the clarification on what kind of water rights issues going forward, that this is not intending to provide exemptions from existing law on the issue of having to get permits or not from water resources.
Chair Clem and members of the committee. Yeah, my suggestion would, I think the phrasing I came up with was something to the effect of nothing in this bill provides an exemption or modifies existing law except as expressly set forth herein, or something like that. And I'll check with our lobbyist on the process for actually offering some specific amendments, and I'd be happy to do that if that's the preferred procedure.
That's great. I think the core issue of why not just go through the existing process is mostly about cost, and nobody is really doing this for financial gain, because you don't really gain by spending this kind of money doing this. So you're either waiting for some sort of OWEB type grant or somebody to pay you to do it, or you can get trying to talk farmers into doing this out of their own sort of calculation that maybe you're going to get some additional forage out of flooding eventually for your hay. I don't know that they'll believe that it's worth it to spend $3 or $4 million restoring a great big giant ranch. Are they really going to make their money back? So that's the challenge, is if it's really a difficult process to go through, people just won't do it and we'll just be stuck with the status quo. And that's the nature of the bill, is to try and figure out how, without getting rid of the sideboards, because these tools already exist in the agencies, as you mentioned, they can already give a waiver and they can already do general authorizations, but how do you make it so it's easier on the agencies with the appropriate sideboards to just say, okay, we don't need to come look at every single one of these and charge you a fee for every single one because we don't have the budget for that and you don't have the money to pay us to do that, and instead we'll just all go home and do nothing, which is what the status quo has been for the last, you know, 75 years. So that's, I think, what we're trying to accomplish. And as I mentioned, Sylvie's had a benefactor who was willing to pay, but not every rancher is going to be willing to spend that kind of money and let OSU set up a facility and bring Onda in to do the work. So I think we're trying to figure out a way for future people who aren't interested in that level of expense to try and you know, have a process the agencies can work with that, you know, doesn't risk precedents all over the state and appropriately puts it in places, maybe not as wide as the Malheur Lakes Basin, but in the targeted watersheds, that kind of thing. Any other questions right now? And we've got Department of State Lands up next. So thank you all.
Thank you.
And let's have DSL come up. Yeah, and folks who are here for the other bills, like, they're going to kick us out of here in 5 minutes. So I am just going to carry over all the other bills till Thursday. And we'll start with those of you who signed up for these on Thursday. Bill.
Chair Clem, committee members, for the record, my name is Bill Ryan. I'm the Assistant Director of the Aquatic Resource Management Program of the Department of State Lands, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify regarding House Bill 3217. As the state agency responsible for conservation of waters of the state, we're always interested in opportunities to support voluntary restoration efforts that improve the state's wetlands and waterways. I'd like to provide some background information regarding the current statutes and what a general authorization is and what a general permit is, to make that clear to the committee. The department has authority to create both general authorizations and general permits for removal fill activities that have predictable effects. And basically, these are streamlined permit tools that that allow a more rapid or less costly authorization for activities within removal and fill activities within waters of the state for certain kinds of activities where we have a good sense of what the level of effect will be. We can predict what's going to happen, and sort of repeatable type of activities that happen frequently, and we have a good sense of what's going to happen. General authorizations are the are limited to activities that have no more than a minimal adverse effect, either individually or cumulatively. And that's a pretty high bar in terms of environmental protection. We have several general authorizations that are available. They're developed through rulemaking. And we've got several of them that are actually associated specifically for or developed specifically for habitat restoration type activities. We have them for waterway habitat restoration, waterway bank stabilization, and wetland habitat restoration, as well as some other sort of routine like a roadway maintenance, pile driving, that sort of thing as well. General authorizations are notice-based, which means they don't require public review for individual projects. So it's basically a pre-authorization of an activity within certain sideboards to limit the effects of that activity. And basically, an applicant is required to notify the department that they're going to participate in this activity, but they don't have to wait for a response from the department or for input from other entities. And so that kind of input is actually captured during the rulemaking process, which has an extensive public involvement and involvement with the sister agencies and that sort of thing. General permits are for a group of activities that are predictable in nature, but that might exceed that minimal adverse impact threshold, either individually or cumulatively for projects. And so they're for, you know, activities are, you know, similar in nature, recurring or ongoing, and have really predictable effects and outcomes, but they can have a greater uncertainty regarding the environmental impacts authorized by a GA, and therefore they have a greater level of scrutiny associated with them. Generally, they will have some sort of a public review and review by state agencies, but perhaps a shortened time period for that. So that's a more rapid way to achieve authorizations. We actually have several general permits currently, and one of them actually is held by the Forest Service, U.S. Forest Service, and the Bureau of Land Management, and specifically for waterway restoration activities. But currently, none of our general authorizations or GPs actually would cover the a structure that completely spans a waterway or that holds water back across the whole waterway. So in order to do an artificial beaver dam type structure, we would need to develop a new general authorization or modify a new general authorization or general permit. So when we develop a GA or GP, it's established through rulemaking with extensive input from a rulemaking advisory committee, as well as public input and public review. And so there's ample opportunity for industry, conservation groups, the public, and state and federal agencies to comment on the rule that's being developed. So it's a pretty robust process to make sure that interests are addressed and the appropriate sideboards, meaning permit conditions, are put into place for a permit. So House Bill 3217 doesn't specify what type of artificial beaver dam construction materials or technology would be used, and just wanted to let folks know that in general, in habitat restoration work, there's a preference to use materials and forms that reflect naturally occurring structures in a given waterway. And so you want these restoration structures to be something that would basically mimic what a natural structure, what a natural beaver dam would accomplish in the landscape or in the watershed. We do have examples of low-risk bioengineering technologies for creating artificial beaver dams or check structures that are those techniques have been used and are widely used throughout the arid west for restoration that I think we could easily include in a general authorization or a general permit, with appropriate sideboards and predictability about what the effects are. Techniques that would involve more non-native materials or forms or larger forms that are not normally found in a natural system would be more challenging to fit under that, but that's the kind of thing that would get worked out through our rulemaking process. And so we do have a couple questions about specific aspects of House Bill 3217. The Section 2.1e defines qualifying streams and includes thresholds for flow, and I would be interested in knowing what the origin of that 3 cubic feet per second for 2 months threshold is. I don't have a problem with it, but just would like to understand what that is and where that came from. The department would also be working closely with the Department of Fish and Wildlife to make sure that that the fish passage exemption and requirements would basically protect native fish populations as required. And finally, just wanted to make the note, let the committee know that there would be some cost to the department associated with the rulemaking, and then for the monitoring and reporting for the pilot, the success of the pilot, what are the outcomes of the pilot. So there'd be some fiscal associated with it as well. And with that, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity and answer any questions.
Any questions for Bill? Officially? Vice Chair Helm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if the issue, it seems to me, is that there's the possibility of these artificial dams staying in place long term. Is there a difference from a permitting point of view in your mind between a dam that has that potential and a dam that is built in a way that's likely to fail within a certain number of years? Just say 5. Much like a real beaver dam could fail in a high water event. Is there any difference there? Would these folks still need a permit if they weren't contemplating more or less permanent withholding of water from a certain area for a long period of time? Sorry, I can't be more articulate about that.
Chair Clem, Vice Chair Helm, I think I understand the question. And so the short answer is that it's the placement of material within the waterway that actually is the permit trigger. Mm-hmm. Now, the what kind of permit tool, whether a general authorization, a general permit, or an individual permit that would be used, is really dependent upon sort of the risk of an unintended effect to the environment. And from that perspective, just in general, a hardscaped, long-term structure has the potential to have a long-term effect or an unpredicted effect, more so than a softer bioengineered structure. That being said, it really depends on the specific situation, and that's the kind of thing where you'd really want to engage folks like hydrologists and fluvial geomorphologists who actually really know, you know, what the effects would be of different types of structures in a specific waterway, because it's also very dependent upon where you are and what watershed you're in.
So it's more the permanence of whatever we're using along the stream bank, and rather than the spanning of the whole stream. Because what I'm hearing is you treat this just like you would some sort of channel armoring activity in terms of permitting.
Chair Clem, Vice Chair Helm. No, I wouldn't characterize it that way. It's really a matter of what is the effect of this activity. So it could well be that a permanent structure that mimics structures that are already there, rock outcrops, or whatever, might be really, you know, may not have a significant concern moving forward, or it might. And so it's not so much the material; it's really the design and how it functions in the landscape, both in the short term and in the long term. That is the critical thing that we'd be looking at as part of the environmental analysis.
Thank you,
Martha. Do you want to come back up and? Let's get the question answered about the 3 cubic feet per second. Given you were a former director of this one, too. I don't know that I realized that until I knew water resources, but I didn't.
Well, it goes way back. thank you again for the record, Martha Pagel. The question of how did we come up with the 3 cubic feet in 2 months per year, it was really an attempt to identify the smaller stream systems and these intermittent or ephemeral stream systems, and there was no magic to it beyond that, so certainly open to input on how to better describe or identify these qualifying streams.
And maybe since we've got you up here, could you talk a little bit about the fish passage issue? I mean, the hard part is, you know, everybody is having to imagine every scenario when you look at a bill. If you've seen one that's clearly dry 90% of the time, there's no fish passage because there's no fish there. It's only after you do the work that you then need to worry about fish passage. But you have to imagine all these things when you're just looking at paper versus these, like, things. I mean, there's steep hills with, they're dry gulches with, I mean, it's like where people go hiking on a trail and someday might be a stream, maybe, you know, but it's absurd once you see it. But I don't know how you write those things into a bill. That's the challenge here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's sort of the challenge that we face of how do you communicate what you're really trying to accomplish here. And as I mentioned earlier, it is certainly not to create any impediment to fish passage. The idea is to get fish back into these streams and to restore conditions that'll bring the fish back. But the problem that we run into with the fish passage law as it's stated right now, I think it was mentioned by Mr. Posowitz or one of the former prior panel that the fish passage laws apply on streams whether they have fish now or historically had fish. And historically is defined to Oregon statehood in 1859. So you have to go through this process whether there's no fish there at all now or not. You know, you're these severely degraded streams and you know they don't have fish. And you know that you could qualify to get a waiver from ODFW, but you have to go through a process with an ODFW up front on every one of these structures to show that whether there were fish there in 1859 and then to make the findings and go through the process. So the idea, again, is to create an incentive where landowners are willing to step forward and do this work, which can be done at a fairly low cost to the landowners in comparison to more traditional types of stream restoration. So there's some real benefits here in the dollar cost, and that's one of the most interesting elements of this whole program, that you can put these artificial beaver dams together for a fairly low cost and potentially improve your land productivity as a result of it to offset it. But you got to get landowners willing to take the chance on it. And the permitting process, the combination of filling out the individual permit with DSL and then going through the waiver process or working with ODFW you know, just creates a block for some people. So again, the idea is not to not to get around those or avoid those, but rather to build it into the program so that the rules that DSL adopts describe what type of structures. Do they span the entire creek, or do they already provide for fish passage, like on one side or the other? The way on Sylvie's Valley Ranch, where this idea has evolved, is that if you have a series of these small structures up the stream, on one side it fills partially and you get passage on one side, and then the next one you get passage on the other side. So you create the fish passage by the way you construct the artificial beaver dams in the first place. I think all of that we intended could be illuminated in the rulemaking process. Maybe it didn't come through in this draft of the bill, but we can certainly work with folks to clarify that.
Representative Gillian.
This is good timing for, I'm speaking mainly for your vice chairs, McLean, and you and I have been through this, but tomorrow night is the night, I think it's OSU in cahoots with Fish and Wildlife, do those artificial dam presentations where they're made to scale for humans. You spend the night on the Mill Creek over at Mission Mill, and then you personally can see how this works in a scale that anyway, it's tomorrow.
Okay,
it's great. Tomorrow, and as you know, that's
We'll be there.
Okay, I'm done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I won't comment on the overnight, whether it's voluntary or not, at Mission Creek. Martha, how much is a permit? In other words, let's quantity.
Free, actually.
between legal expense, permit to, or application, and et cetera, et cetera. How much would one ABD cost if he had to permit each one? Do we have an estimate?
Maybe I'll defer to Bill on that.
Sure, Chair Clem, Representative McLean. The actual permit fee itself for an individual permit would be, depending upon the size of the structure that you're creating, or the, how many structures, the total volume, would be anywhere from a couple hundred to a couple thousand dollars, generally more in the couple hundred realm, because the fees actually go up when you get into, you know, thousands of cubic yards of material, which I don't think we'd be looking at for most applications here. For our general permits, we have similar fees. For a general authorization, actually, if it's less than 50 cubic yards, there's no fee associated. If they're above that, it's $250 for a general authorization. So the cost of the permit fee itself is actually a pretty small piece, I think, of the total project cost, the design and construction and maintenance of a structure, much more expensive than the actual permit fees themselves.
And Mr. Chair, Representative McLean, just for a visual effect, this is the application that we're working on for the OSU study research project on Cottonwood Creek at Sylvie's Valley Ranch. It's pretty intense. So it's not just the application fee, it's filling out the forms and providing the very detailed information about how the diagrams of how the weirs or the ABDs are constructed and how much material is involved. It's legitimate information that the state needs, but it's a complicated process, and that alone is enough to discourage landowners from moving forward. And why, if you can have sort of a preset specifications in the rule, it makes it a lot easier to move forward.
Mr. Chair, I tend to agree that this, I sure hope the opponents can find a way to yes, because this has a lot of benefits. I think you and I
we've seen
it together, and but I think Ms. Tagle and between the cost and what she's shown, that it seems quite silly for the state to have such a burden for people to do the right thing.
I think it's a system that was largely meant to do some sort of development activity that then you make your money back versus fixing up the environment where you're not expected to gain much out of it, maybe some additional forage. But for most of them, it's easier just to pump more water because they all have the water rights. And so why would you do this when you can just take more water out of the system it's far cheaper to just use your existing water right than it is to go through something like this that would have all these ecological benefits. And so we're trying to morph a system meant for something else into a you almost need an environmental restoration permit, probably like your GAs for the Forest mm-hmm. Service and these other folks. We're just trying to get one that other people could use as well, who are far less comfortable working with units of government probably than another unit of government is, and B, probably doesn't have counsel on their staff at their farm the way the Forest Service and other do to help use their salary time to get all these things done to get their general authorization permits.
If you agree that, Mr. Chair, that it's a pilot program, if you don't, I understand. Yeah. But if you do, I'm with you. Let's do this, work out the details. But let's do it and see what the results are and see if we can address the concerns and move forward.
The thing we just, I think, need to make sure we get right is you don't want somebody using this program like taking what's on the page.
Yeah.
We're divining good intent onto people. You don't want them using it in a bad way just to store water for themselves to use and calling it a beaver dam.
Right.
So,
Mr. Chair, should that be the case, we could always make corrective action later.
Yeah, that's
true. In other words, let's not let the fear of that keep us from doing the right thing.
Well, that's great. Senator, let me just carry over a few bills here real quick. Carry over House. Let me close the public hearing on House Bill 3217. Carry over House Bills 344, HJM 13, House Bill 3240, House Bill 2723, and House Bill 3457. And adjourned. And adjourned.